Welcome to Starfleet Universe On-Call. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I run SFB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder, join us. We have Talkcast every Thursday night starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either join us on the phone, just dial 605-562-0444. That's follow the directions. And the call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to the Talk's website at www.talkshoe.com. And search for call ID 17702. And remember, bring your Chrome or Chromium-based browser with you because they don't like anything else. And, if of course, there is the stream on twitch.tv. So go to twitch.tv/SFUOnCall. I'd be happy to chat with you there. I'm always co-streaming in TalkShoe and I'm doing it over on Twitch, so hope to see you there. And if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. That's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, if you need to follow me on Twitter, my Twitter account there is sfuoncall. Also, my personal account is Paul Franz, PaulFranz. Just a note on that, is I talk about being Catholic and always I'm happy to share good podcasts about that. And also, I love talking about tech and some every once in a while about SFB itself, which is always awesome to talk about. And of course, this lovely Talkcast gets turned into a podcast available on iTunes and various feeds around the net. And by the way, I'm working on getting Google Play to back to work because I think the problem where the episodes were missing, and that's why there are some problems with Google Play. I'm running forward to the news for this week. Steve Cole, of course, was busy working on the Throne Master Starship book, and same for Steve Petrick. And Jean, oh my, Jean got married this week to her sweetheart, Al. Congratulations to Jean. Of course, she's been busy working on product updates and also keep an eye on that Thalian Master Starship book. Make sure there's no little editorial comments that are required, like you misspelled the word "the." Little things like that. Moving on to the SFB Online Tournament, the Starfire Star Tournament 3. Not much happening there. We do have a replacement player, because Brian Evans was scheduled to go on vacation. Might be a little bit longer than we expect. We'll have to wait and see on that, given the whole virus situation. You never know, you know. So, you know, round two is still not completed. But, you know, we'll see how far that goes. When it comes to online clients, in case you missed it, I did put out a new one last week that fixes a few minor issues, but also adds support for adding new empires into the ship library without actually having to modify the client itself. Previously, that was done in a very unexpensive way, very limited way, and I apologize for that because it should have been in there all along. But anyway, going back to the library, unfortunately, nothing has been newly converted. We have some updates, which Frank has been working on. Thank you, Frank, for fixing those ships that you found issues with. So the completely converted stays at 2,522, with yet to be converted 799, with the percent complete to be 75.94%. And with that, that is the news for this week. And it's me, it's the one, the only Paul Franz, welcoming you to Starfleet Universe On Call. And tonight we have a guest with us, which we had not had for quite a bit, and that is one Gary. How you doing, Gary?
I'm doing okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, can hear you just fine. Actually, Barry's not going to be here tonight because he's actually at home because his work said, everyone, go home. And him being home, that means his wife went, honey, I want to spend some time with you. Big surprise. So I was like, yeah, we could have him join the call, but most probably his wife's going to be talking in his ear the whole time. So we figured the best of it. We just, well, I'll talk to you later. So, my dear, sweet friend from up north, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. Just wanted to actually note for anyone who's listening, TalkShoe have actually posted a help page, that lists a series of international numbers that are counted as being quote-unquote in-country. So, for example, if you're in Canada or Ireland or the UK or New Zealand or a few other countries, they have a list of dial-in numbers that people can call so that they basically won't count as an international call to the US in order to get through. So I would recommend if there is anybody that wants to pop in, but they're outside of the United States, then they should check out that help page. And yep, there's a way that they can do that. And then once they're signed in on the TalkShoe website, they can generate a PIN number so that when you call in, they'll know that it's you that is speaking, if you are signed up for TalkShoe, I guess.
Right. Right. They auto-identify your phone number. Yes. Understood. I've got that set up for my cell phone. For me, whenever I dial in, it's like, okay, you're this. It's like, yeah, but I don't want you to be that. Because every once in a while, I've had problems with calling in via Skype. And it's been really good these days. Then they switched over to Free Conference as their backbone. That's their third-party provider. TalkShoe has actually gotten quite much, much better, because I think before it was like Magic Jack is what they were using. It was really weird when those things wouldn't connect. But as you notice from the list, we have South Africa, Switzerland, Ukraine, UK, of course, Poland, New Zealand. I have a hard time believing someone actually calling it from New Zealand. But you never know. Israel, of course, Ireland, Hungary, Germany, Finland, Denmark, Canada, up north, and of course, Australia. Wow. I'm just thinking about the time differences for some of these calls. Because I think Australia is, I don't know, geez, so like 12 hours or more. It's like, I forget. And of course, given that it's now daylight savings time for the US, it makes things a little bit interesting, a little not as bad when it comes to the UK for the next couple of weeks. And then they go to British summertime, in which case now it'll be 5 hour difference again. So if you want to call in at 2:30 in the morning, you can't sleep, hey, we're here. So actually, curious, is there any particular thing that you want to discuss? Because one thing I wanted to at least quickly bring up, which was one of the things that you mentioned last week, which was the caps log number 48, 50, and 52, which was some of the Zosman updates, and also the Dramakian new light cruiser, which I actually, I scanned it in, and right now I've got it up on my screen so people can see what that actually looks like. Because that's one thing I planned on doing, which is finish off the whole talking of the Dramakians, pirates, and the tournament, possible tournament cruiser. Obviously, this is still kind of weak overall because of the BPV that's involved. Because normally the BPV that you want to have for a tournament cruiser is somewhere around 130, 140. Depending upon the ship, could go up as high as 150. And that usually depends on the strengths and weaknesses, because in my mind, the BPV doesn't always tell the story of the ship. They try, that one number is supposed to represent it, how well it can fight in combat. But normally, in my mind, those numbers are designed for fleets. I think they're more designed for fleets and less defined for dual action, which is, of course, tournament ships. And so just,
well,
oh,
one thing is, I guess, in the Lesser Magellanic Cloud, relying on move cost one ships is problematic because the setting is not really designed for that. I mean, they're designed to be the fleet flagships, like the Battle of Strike Cruiser and so forth. So none of them are actually designed to, even the ones for the three great powers, they're not designed to be equal to each other, historically, let alone in a tournament. So it's generally the best you can do is to have the equivalent of like light or war cruisers. So like the Magadine light cruiser or the Batavai or Nien, but any new light cruiser, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And in that context, I mean, the Othiki one's a bit of a shame because it's not a real Othiki ship. It's like a Batavai ship that's been like converted or whatever. So it's like if you had in the Alpha Octans, if you had a tournament where the only Romulan ship was the Kestrel and you couldn't take the King Eagle or the Firehawk, whatever. So, but at least with the Jumaki and the new light cruiser, I mean, it's in the same sort of ballpark as the war cruisers of the other empires and stuff. And you could probably throw an Andromedan Mamba in there as well. Or what's it called again? There's a specific word, a trait for the Andromedans. And you could have them be part of things, whatever. So, but that would be basically more for a self-contained thing.
Right.
I guess it wouldn't really be ideal for matching up with Alpha or Omega opponents, but
which is,
you know, I suppose.
Yeah, that's the one thing that we have discussed, me and Gary. Sorry, Barry, not Gary. You guys are too close in names. But anyhow, and that is that. Definitely, when it comes to the Alpha versus Omega, I said, I think it's foolhardy to actually try to have them as a single integrated tournament, have the Omegas added to the Alphas. I think it's foolhardy to think that. Try to make a separate tournament, which is just for Omegas, and do that. Now, I know that with what Barry had been doing is also he had brought in some of the LMC ships, which, of course, brings up the whole question of whether even, you know, LMC ships should be facing Omegas at all, you know, and my guess is probably that shouldn't, you know, have a separate LMC tournament just because of they're supposed to be fighting each other, at least more closely than, you know, trying to fight the Omegas because they never really interacted with the Omega Octant. So,
there is a note in Module C5 that Iridani or Belusco might occasionally show up in Omega prior to Operation Unity, just on long-range quests and stuff, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a scenario where inside the core region, even, the Magadine basically stumble across this old Soldra Dark Matter cache. But the Soldra basically finds that the shielding in the LMC doesn't really work too well with their weapon. Like their systems don't really, because they're designed to do a lot of, like, you know, attrition attacks and stuff, and that's pretty tricky to do against the, you know, the volume reduction factor. So,
right,
Soldra aren't really. I mean, I guess if they can land hits with the vampire shards and try to suck the life out of their opponents, that's one way. But by and large, they're not in great shakes trying to operate out there. So. But anyway, I suppose, but the thing is that there is, in Captain's Log 51, there's an article about the USS Zakharov. There's like a advanced technology galactic survey cruiser that basically pioneered getting to and from Omega via the LMC. And once that happens, then things start changing. But that's one reason, actually, I'm looking forward to on Shapeways, because now they're starting to do X ships.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about the the CX has been added. And of course, one of the CXs is USS Bunker Hill, which is appropriately numbered NCC 1776. The command ship for the Starfleet Task Force that went to Operation Unity. And part of the task force was also the Sakharov. So it was basically in the LMC for quite some time, even before it set out to Omega. And then, although I should note that the article was written by a certain somebody, so whether the article's any good, I wouldn't want to be the one to say if it is or not, but hopefully people would find it interesting.
Mm-hmm. Let me just make sure I understand this, which is, I don't think you said the name of the Federation GSX that actually went to the Omega via the LMC.
Yeah, so what happened was that in the original version of that part of the Omega timeline, the name of the ship is the same. It's NCC 1821 USS Sakharov.
Sakharov, okay.
And originally, there was meant to be some sort of wormhole that in Y214, which the Sakharov traveled through. And then it took the long way around, like after 5 years of exploring Omega, to get back to the Alpha Options. But that version of events was since retconned, because in Captain's Log 41, there was an article by Nick Samaras, which talked about, basically it was like a class history article for all of the Galactic Survey cruisers.
Right.
And it mentioned that the new version of events is that what happened is that the Sakharov, after Operation Unity, it spent 10 years in the LMC, helping to deal with the Andromedan leftovers in that island galaxy. And then in Y212, the Sakharov actually set out from the LMC to Omega, following one of the old RTN routes that the Andromedans had established going into Omega. And then the article in CL51 is basically an expansion on that. Like, it goes into more detail as to what the Sakharov was up to, both before and after Operation Unity, and also during its trip in Omega. So that basically is like the first time that real first contact kind of takes place between the two regions, in the sense that a ship would go there and then come back again. So, after that point, the door would be more open for contact between Omega and the LMC, as well as Alpha and Omega.
Mm-hmm.
So,
understood.
That wouldn't necessarily, that would be more like the era of like X1 or X2 ships as well. So,
right.
How many of the ships that we know about would still be in service by then? Although, I mean, there is a scenario in another Captain's Log, which basically has the Jumokians try to backstab a couple of ISC ships because they want to try to get a hold of the PPD. So,
interesting idea. So Sakharov actually after spending a lot of time in the LMC, comes back and follows an RTN network into the Omega Octant. Now,
Right. Given
that, I'm assuming that becomes a bridge from the Alpha to the Omega Octant in the future, past Y-2112?
Well,
212?
I don't know how much of the story to give away. I mean, it's been a couple of years since CL-51 was published, but the Sakharov basically destroys the RCN nodes that it encounters on the way there, so that the Andromedans can't use it.
But, understood.
Then you'd be left with the question as to, you think about it, after Operation Unity, each of the three routes that the Alpha Empires use to get, the various chains of mobile bases that they would establish,
Right. They
suddenly become waypoints for ongoing contact, because a number of the empires have basically commit themselves to, a long-term presence to help get rid of, make sure that the Andromedans can't use the cloud to rebuild or to return or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like Sakharov and ones belonging to other empires, you know, are basically out there on a routine basis. So like when it comes to Omega and the LMC, there'd need to be some sort of similar route established.
Yeah, the reason, the supposition I was coming up with was that it's not faster, definitely easier to get from the alpha to the alpha octant to the omega octant, go via a pathway at least close to the LMC, if not to the LMC and back. Because my assumption is that someone figures out a way of traversing from the alpha to the omega octant using that same kind of corridors that were between the Milky Way and LMC, and there might be a shortcut in there somewhere where it's close, you know, so you don't have to go all the way up to the LMC and come back down. That's my assumption.
Well, I mean, the thing as well is that, I mean, there isn't really, because even for the Operation Unity, we haven't yet seen what that actually means in like Federation and Empire terms.
Right.
Because, I mean, the distance between the galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy and the LMC is still quite substantial.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that somehow ships are going faster than, because, I mean, there's a list of warp factors that we know about when you're actually in the galaxy. I mean, like how fast a ship, like a Constitution class ship, can go from one star system to another.
Right.
But those ratings are not fast enough to account for the kind of campaign times that are presented for Operation Unity. So it seems to be that somehow ships are basically traveling faster in the intergalactic void than they are within a galaxy, which I suppose in a sense could make sense, because when you're in a galaxy, if you're traveling using operational movement, you need to make sure that your navigator is keeping tabs on any, like, you know, planets or stars or black holes or nebulae and so forth, or
right,
rogue comets or anything that your ship could basically splash into if you're not aiming it properly. Whereas when you're out in the near void of space, there are very few terrain features that your ship can accidentally smash into. So
understood. Even if you're just talking about,
once you're out there,
even if you're just talking about dust particles, you know, within a Milky Way where it's collecting those, you know, bringing them closer and closer to the center of the galaxy, you know, it's going to be less so outside the galaxy. At least I would assume.
And that was interesting, because, I mean, like in the real world, it's not quite as simple as that, because like there are a number of globular clusters, and there's even a thing called the Magellanic Stream or the Magellanic Bridge, where it's like there's like a stream of particles that are kind of going through the galactic core, and then they're kind of looping their way through both the greater and lesser Magellanic Cloud. So there's all sorts of like little kind of things going on or whatever. So, mm-hmm. But I guess for the Alpha Empires, a lot of the work had been done for them by the Andromedans, because
right. The
Andros had spent 30 years between their first wave of conquest and the LMC and their invasions of the Alpha and Omega often. So they are the ones who basically, you know, figured out what these routes are. So they would have already, you know, been able to take the time to establish, like, you know, what are the safest routes and how far apart the bases need to be, you know, to make sure that you've got enough, you know, of a viable network to get
right. Yourself
to and from the galaxy, the East galaxy. So all the Alpha Empires have to do is pretty much just follow that in reverse, like the kind of stuff that you see in the Operation Unity campaign and Starfleet Battles, at least. So one of the many reasons why I'm looking forward to the eventual work on Andro War for Federation and Empire, because I very much doubt that the standard version of Andro War would come with a more detailed map of the LMC, but if it had at least some sort of tools with which to understand the real like logistics behind Operation Unity, I think that would be pretty interesting.
Right. At the very least, you know, having the LMC just represented as an amorphous cloud of destination, you know, even if they just stick with that, and the whole idea is the logistics between the Milky Way and the LMC.
But the other thing is that one of the other things that's interesting too is that when it comes to the empires that may or may not stay in the cloud after Unity, the Tholians, for one, especially because there's some of the background article that's been stuff that's been added for them, like in the Prime Directive context, their long-term interest is to establish a base, a line of routes towards Draco, because a ship from a few ships from the Draco Tholians arrive in the midst of the Andromedan War, but the Tholians can't do anything in terms of going back there until after Operation Unity is done. So it'd be interesting to see, do the Tholians basically pull out of the LMC entirely and then focus what resources they have on, you know, establishing a chain of bases to get to the Draco? Because it's said that, I think that happens in, they get back there and like, I think it's either Y206 or Y207. And to them, of course, that would be the number one priority because they'd want to, you know, support their fellow Tholians. So, but I'd be curious to see even, when do the other empires even find out about this? I mean, is it public knowledge that there are Tholians in Draco, or do the Tholians try to keep it secret so that someone else won't try to destroy them or something?
I agree.
I agree. Another thing that
there's not a lot of trust there. You know, it's you know, they don't really trust the other empires at all, and which is understandable given their issues with the Seltorians. You know, they thought they could trust them, and
well,
they
also
got backstabbed, you know.
Well, part of the thing is that, I mean, the Tholians kind of feel pretty, you know, dismissive of all carbon-based life forms. Like, they basically don't rate them as, like, real beings or whatever. So, but, I mean, the thing is that, I mean, as a matter of practicality, I mean, they've had to rely on various carbon-based life forms during the General War to survive, and also as a when taking part in Operation Unity. So there would probably be, you know, and it'll be curious to see, because I mean, like, if slash when Module X2 comes out, I mean, I guess the main focus will be on making the actual ships themselves work. But
agreed.
For me, the other main draw would be basically all these things that are happening that have never happened before in the Alpha Octants. And actually it wouldn't have been a factor had Module X2 been done, you know, back in the 80s or early 90s or something. I mean, it's basically the Starfleet universe has grown so much in the last 30, 40 years that the opportunities are so much richer now for X2 to really, if not address these issues directly, but at least provide the stepping stone for, you know, other products to follow those stories up.
To me, I be honest, I'm not as excited about the second generation, though obviously I think that'd be quite interesting, because the tough part is with second generation at all is just the whole idea of what is the next generation of ships look like. It's not just, you know, stronger, faster ships. You know, what's the next leap that takes place? You know, the biggest leap, obviously, the going from non-warp tactical drives. The first leap was just from non-warp drives to having warp drives that you could go strategically, so you can move between stars in a relatively short period of time. And then there's, of course, there's the tactical warp, which is the next leap. Then the next leap after that, you know, when it comes to combat, is you know, second generation, I think is what this is being seen as that. Now, to be honest, I'm not as excited about that as if what I really would like to see the Tholian home galaxy. That's what I would like to see. That would be interesting to me.
Well, that would be an opportunity to, because there already have been a couple of the old Galaxy Pirates ships in both as ship cards and as SFDs in Captain Log 40.
Yeah.
And there's an article in CL 41 that goes into more detail of who these guys are and what they're about and stuff. So, and also, I mean, like, as a setting, you'd have no seeking weapons and not much in the way of scout usage and stuff. I mean, you wouldn't have ship based special sensors and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it looks like, you know, hopefully in the rules would work pretty cleanly in Federation Commander and a Call to Arms Starfleet as well as in SFB. So you wouldn't have to worry too much about porting them over.
Right, right. And my assumption, given what the Tholians started with, my assumption is that things like fighters or gunships didn't exist.
Yeah, there's no. I mean, there's already notes about in both the Tholian and the Centaurian R sections, basically saying that things like fighters and PFs, T-bombs even, suicide shuttles and so forth, none of those existed in the home galaxy. So it's a much more clean environment in that sense.
Oh, yeah.
But what's interesting is that the guys who initially built the home galaxy pirate ships, because the pirate ships that we know about are kind of like export models. I kind of think about how the Orions built export versions of the pirate ships for the wind cluster, but the wind ships don't have engine doubling. That's what
right. Right.
So the home galaxy pirate ships, I mean, they can use things like particle cannons and shield crackers and so forth. But the species or empire faction, whatever, that initially built those ships, they're called the Nebuline. But supposedly those ships have unique technology that allow them to fight well in a nebula, which is a place where Tholians can't use web properly.
Mm-hmm.
So that would actually be interesting to see. Because apparently, the other thing as well is that the home galaxy pirate ships have a big wing on the port side,
right,
that allows them to like dock to freighters. And the Nebuline raider ships that have the same design, like with the big wing. But supposedly the ships of the Nebuline Star Navy don't have the wings. They just look like kind of like the center hull of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the old days, those ships tried and failed to fight the Tholians in open space. But nowadays, those wingless ships are used in each of the nebulae that the Nebuline are hiding in. They use them as basically kind of like a defense force in case the Tholians come in and try to destroy them.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, as I said, I really like to see it because obviously there's more empires. Well, jeez. I'm just thinking about the history of the Tholian empire and them basically their iron fist rule of their galaxy, basically. You know, not sure what we would have. You know, what would have a product when it comes to the old Tholian galaxy, the Tholian home galaxy, be like before the uprising or what, you know, because, you know, obviously, you know, if, you know, the other empires at all would ever resist the Tholian will, that they were basically destroyed. At least that's my understanding.
Well, I mean, you could, like it said that the technology didn't change an awful lot out there. So, maybe they could do like the empires that the Tholians fought in the first place to conquer the galaxy, including the Nebuline. And then one or more of the subject species, or the enforcer species that the Tholians used before they got to the Sultorians. So, and then you could see more pirates. I don't know if there's room for more variations of the home galaxy pirate ships. So you could, see more about those and where that would take you.
Mm-hmm.
But then you could also see like what's happening to the home galaxy after the Sultorians take over. Cause,
yes.
There's at least one, it's not clear as to whether it's actually a real story or not, or if it's like a dramatization. Mm-hmm. But in Captain's Log 41, there's both a small fiction piece and a scenario called Fire in the Deep. And the idea, the premise is that the Sultorians' hive ship called Star of Redemption was on its way after some other Tholian group. But then this juggernaut basically showed up and said that it was from the target galaxy and it was heading towards M81, and that it and its predecessors had already destroyed the Tholians that were heading in their direction. And then you're next, basically. So there's a scenario basically showing the hive ship with a bunch of Sultorian ships trying to fight off a fleet of Juggernaut Empire warships and stuff. Now, again, it's not 100% been confirmed that they really are Juggernaut ships. But if they were, then that could be an interesting... like, how would the Sultorians or whoever is still around in M81, how would they react? Because they no longer have the same kind of setup that they had when the Tholians were in charge.
Agreed. But, it sounds like it was like a short story about, it's like, oh, what's that one? Oh. I know there's a story with, I think it was like a Lyran or an LDR ship who got a glimpse at, I think, was it Omega? I think it was either Omega or LMC. Through glitch in subspace is the best way I can describe it. It was a really short story. It sounds like that kind of story. You know,
you might be thinking of because the cover story for one of the captain's logs has a Lyran ship encounter this vortex.
Right, that's
the other side of the vortex. Some species that's actually they haven't actually confirmed where that other empire is, but
that's true.
Like I think the author had a few ideas as to who they are, but those ideas are not official. So whether they actually anyone would ever see them again or not is another story. But I think that's the one that you might be thinking of.
Yeah. If if they're like the Zorkalians, you're in trouble. Oh man, that's the one thing. Another one that I would love to see, which is with the Sargasso octant. Or am I think I got that wrong. What's the octant where the Zorkalians are in?
Well, okay, so the Sargasso storm zone is the octant that's between Alpha and the Zorkalian home. You could probably call the Zorkalian home territory a quadrant because it covers 6 full sectors on the galactic map. The galaxy map has 24 sectors, and mm-hmm. 4 of the sectors have either 3 or 4. They're in groups of 3 or 4, I guess. Whereas the Zorkalian one, they've actually got 6 adjacent sectors all to themselves. And I'm going to post the link in the...
Wow.
Yeah, if you have a look on there, I just clicked on the link on there. But
thanks.
Yeah, Sargasso is the one where... the report is that most of Sargasso... the open space gets, clogged up by these massive ion storms. And when the storms subside, these empires that are holed up in these pockets of open space, they get a few years where they can basically scramble for resources. And then when the next storm hits, they run home again and kind of like sit out the next wave of storms until the cycle repeats and so on. And it's alleged that a group of Carnivons actually escaped Balearans and Xintes and is in one of those enclaves now. So, but they're far too busy trying to stay alive to worry about coming back.
Understood. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's one thing we don't have much about, which is the Delta, which is right next to the Alpha Octant. Liren and Hydran space. You know that side. Because obviously with ISC, they're pretty much not quite, but pretty close to the void itself, which separates the Alpha and the Omega Octant.
Well, there's an updated version of the galaxy map in the new version of GURPS Prime Directive, and it basically shows that there's actually like an extension of the nearest void that's blocking the old colonies from the Lyran Far Stars. So the Hydrans and Lyrans can't meet each other out there. But like in Delta, you'd find the homeworld stuff like the Borak and the Palladium and stuff, but you wouldn't find there's no other major empire to be found out there.
Oh, yeah. So but I'm just wondering if there's any minor empires that are in that sliver. You know?
If there had been, it would have already been taken over, as what happened with the Palladium and Borak. But the Lyrans do, they lease a portion of their outback for the Klingons to explore. So there's actually like a strip of territory that would be out there that is under lease to the Klingon Empire. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely have a big section of the Milky Way to explore. And Lord knows there's so much different weapon systems and different ship designs that can be in that can be added, you know, can be created, you know, that so much that's unexplored. Interesting. Which was, I wanted to bring up that one. Okay. Okay. Just wanted to bring up another one real quick. Since we're... Now... Definitely, as you pointed out in your email, that the Zosman Marauder Defense Cruiser is basically a cargo ship, is what it is. Because it has a large section of cargo. And so that this wouldn't be a really appropriate one for a tournament cruiser. You'd want a heavy cruiser for that. See if I can see it real quick. If I don't, I can. Let's be able to do this. Zosman Heavy Cruiser. I'll bring that up real fast so people can see it. I thought I closed that. Thank you. Yeah, still, you know, when it comes to ships, it's pretty lightweight when it comes to BPV, you know, only being 95 points of BPV. So when it comes to the Omega Octant, you know, they're overall pretty light, and it most probably would have to be reinforced. One of those things we have to look at, and we're not going to discuss the whole Zosman their system so forth like we do with Barry. I just wanted to bring it up just to show people what it looks like. This was what Kepslog what 50 number 50, which is interesting because I'm looking through all the rules that are here. The heavy weapon option mounts labeled A, B, C, and A and B and C and D can hold any heavy weapon not restricted to simulated use. The two mounts are considered to be centerline adjacent, and so forth. But definitely that will be interesting in the future when Barry comes back. Whoops.
Hello?
Whoops.
Hi, Paul. Sorry. I pressed the wrong button by accident, so I actually had to call back in.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But, the thing is, though, is that, the Zosmans are rainy about being pirates and stuff. So, with their ship, because you can take the energy howitzers and stuff. So, if you had that, then you've got all those boarding parties that you can use to try and board an enemy ship. So that probably doesn't happen as much in a tournament than it would historically, but it would be an option for players if, I guess, they wanted to do that. So.
Right, I agree.
But there are actually some very... some of the weapon options that they can take, even aside from that, can actually be quite useful and stuff, so... it might look like it's not that much because they just got the heavy cruiser just has six phaser mounts and four heavy weapon mounts, but some of the weapon mounts you can put in there can be quite interesting, so it would be quite as bad off. But the trick though would be to figure out what to do with the stealth field, because in SFE it obliges both sides to use passive fire control, and it's makes the ship invisible beyond a certain range, but neither of those really apply in tournaments. So,
No, understood. And it's serious, as I pointed out, the BBB is low, but I'm not quite so sure that it's not, it couldn't, fight. Obviously, the as you mentioned, the whole issue is the number of weapons are very low. You got six phasers, and then you have four other weapons. So that makes things hard. Now, looking at it, has I assume jammers are part our Zosman system.
Yeah. They're from the Hivers, actually.
Okay. Yeah, because that's one thing you can also select four system boxes, and they say system can be jammer, special sensor, or barracks. Obviously, for us barracks would be kind of pointless in a tournament. Same for a special sensor, which leaves jammer, which I'd have to look to see what jammers were when it comes to the Hivers.
Well, the thing is that they're kind of sort of like a special sensor themselves, so you'd probably have to just set barracks, but because in SFB, even when you get the barracks, you still have to pay extra for the boarding parties that you're putting in there, so
right.
You'd basically at this point, I guess, treat barracks as another whole box or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Oh, agreed. Well, I would want to look at the jammer anyway just to see if it might have some usefulness in tournament play, where I know we have very limited EW, but if it has some functions outside of providing additional EW, then maybe that would be good enough,
Actually, the other thing as well is that the BPV is a bit low because you have to pay extra for the warp refit, but presumably the version that's in the tournament would pay the extra points to bring it up to speed 30. So part of the point differential will be taken up there. So
okay, I wish it was listed on the. I assume the cost for the warp refit is mentioned in the description. Because at the moment, I don't see it. See ship description. Okay.
Oh, you're right. I don't have my copy of Steel 50 with me, but there was a note somewhere about. Hang on, I'll be right back.
Okay. Because I actually have it here with me, just in case. For those people who are just listening in and not actually watching, I showed the camera that I have it here. Where's the? Oh, and it was like, was this the part of the Zosman update or something else? Shipyard, maybe it's in the shipyard report. So I'm not used to looking things up in this. So
okay, I'm on the I have the large print edition, so the pages are a bit different,
right?
But BPV goes up to 115 points.
Oh, okay.
And also the cost to operate the stealth field at its lowest level goes up to 10 more points of warp power as well.
Okay, so and that requires definitely warp power. Okay.
I'm just trying to remember that, actually. I think so. Sorry, I've got the page up. I'm looking at the rules now.
Understood. Yeah, it was more of a curiosity question than anything else, just because...
Maybe not, actually. I'm just trying to figure that out, actually.
Because I know for the Romulans, it doesn't require warp power. But for the Jamakians and their kind of getaway free card kind of thing, as we mentioned last week with the Jamakians... The Jamakians, their distortion field was mainly designed as let's use it and let's get out of here kind of thing. Less for a tactical weapon or system, sorry.
Yeah, I think the stealth field, because technically speaking, like if a ship drops its warp engines, it can actually operate a stealth field. But the cost is like pretty tiny because the main cost, the main source of need for the stealth field comes from the warp engine itself.
Right. Cause it has the...
But also bear in mind that the syndicate base that's in, 52, that unit also has a cost to run its stealth field. So, and it doesn't have any warp engines either. So, but I think what happens is that the stealth field cost, it kind of it's cumulative, I guess, because if you've got, like, say, two heavy cruisers or a heavy cruiser and a defense cruiser docked together with the syndicate base, then I guess there's, like, a larger cost overall because you're trying to keep all three stealth or whatever.
Right. Definitely would be a good idea just to have... Okay. But wasn't the Zosman cloak also meant for cloaking on a strategic level versus because like the Orion, the Romulans and the Orion's cloaking devices are mainly meant for as a tactical level thing for the most part. Though they can, I think they can use it strategically.
Yeah, I mean, in FME, though, a cloaked ship is much slower on the operational speed than a non-cloaked ship. But they haven't, there's no confirmation as to what the equivalent is for the stealth field. But yeah, basically the stealth field, I'm sorry, just 1 second here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the stealth field once, because like, okay, so the way it works is that once the stealth field is active, then you have to look at your tactical intelligence chart, because beyond a certain level, you simply can't see the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what it is like, say if you're approaching a scout, then the range is like 12 or 15 hexes or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's very close. And that actually goes both ways. So for example, if you're attacking a planet or a space, you can get a lot closer when you're actually planning the attack. But also if you're the syndicate base hiding from the other guys, it's really difficult to actually find you if you don't want to be found. So that's one reason. And also because what happens is the fence cruiser, what it would do is that it would basically travel from the home region in the Phi sector to the various syndicate bases and drop off supplies and pick up loot and transfer personnel and so forth, and then go back home again. So,
right. Right, because of the Zosman, as an quote-unquote empire, it's the reason, my understanding, if I recall correctly, the reason why they were doing what they were doing is mainly out of survival.
Well, the home, so in CL-52, there's more info about what the Zosman history is. So they have like a series of home planets called the Collective.
Right.
And then there's a series of independent marauder colonies. And supposedly the colonies are the ones who operate the pirate ships or whatever. And but interestingly enough, the ships that are in the home region, they actually use a standardized set of weapons, so they don't use the same variety that you see on the map. They basically just use the same standard weapons that the Meterons use. So they use tachyon guns, tachyon missiles, and wide-angle phasers.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
But because of the option mounting, it generally makes sense to pick one type of heavy weapon and for per ship and stick with that.
Right.
So you wouldn't necessarily have the same kind of variety that you'd have on an Orion ship.
Understood. And I don't think the Zosman have territory per se either. You know.
Well, the home planets are out in the Phi sector, so they do their best to try to keep everyone else out of it. But then even they have problems with the Andromedans and the Soldier later on. But they don't necessarily have cartel zones on the map. What they have is each individual cell operates in a certain region or whatever, but they're probably too far apart from each other to threaten each other in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But they would have basically, they'd rely on the weapons that they can source from the local territories.
Right, right. Which makes sense. That's the beauty of having option mounts is that you use what's available. You know, you're not stuck with a certain weapon system, which you might not be able to find parts for if you're so far from home. You know.
But one of the interesting things is that, like, for example, if you're in around warp territory, you can use all those anti-proton phasers and beams and so forth that the warp themselves can use, or that the Yamatrians used to be able to use. So you can actually put together a pretty dangerous ship. Even you could either go all anti-proton phasers and then do a lot of damage at really close range, or you could use the option boxes to install, say, a lance and two APVs. So if you line someone up on the center line, you can damage them too.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I was just reading right here. Well, for those on the video can see what I'm talking about, which is insert, you know, the phaser table for phaser selected. Note, the ship might have six different phasers or phaser-like weapons, and not as required to have all the phasers of the same type. Which makes things quite interesting in my mind. Because basically you can select...
The other thing is that...
You can set. Well, I was going to mention that, you know, that means you can select the best phasers, you know, that are available, you know, best point phasers, best, you know, more offensive phasers, you know, and combination of those. And what were you going to say, Barry?
Well, in a tournament setup, I'd probably suggest. Maybe offer advising a set based on where the ship is operating. So, for example, if you offer, like, say, a Mistron package, just say that all of the phasers are wide angle phaser ones and that you're using tachyon guns or tachyon missiles in the option mounts, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, or if you're near FRA space, you can take regular phaser ones and load them on photon torpedoes or something like that. So, because as we were saying earlier, it's probably advisable with this ship to just focus on one empire at a time in terms of what you're trying to do with the ship.
Right, right. The one thing, obviously, when it comes to tournaments, is that normally you have for a, like an Orion ship, you would have like two packages, so you could actually select which one you want to have. And probably for like the Zosman, they probably have the same idea, which you have two different packages. So in theory, you could have two different areas if you want to go along those lines where you have fixed packages, but you can choose either, you can choose one of two, or have, so you can't change option their packages, you know. Of course, I've seen multiple Orions where they choose one package and they usually stick with that package, and they have an alternate package for those special situations, usually Andromedans, that they want to have package available, because, which drives, of course, me nuts. Because, you know, for the Andromedan, normally you don't have the, in some cases, I think you don't even need the alternate package. Because in those cases, I'm thinking about the phaser boat, where the five option mounts, you've got one phaser G and four phaser ones, and so you're just running around at high speed, just baiting on the Andromedan, you know. And in theory, you don't need that. You could use normal hellbores and so forth, but it just makes for a longer battle. And give the Andromedan actually a better opportunity to win. So, anyway.
One other thing as well is the FRA have the shuttle bombs that the Zosmans gain access to, but they're not as advanced in terms of miniaturization as the originals. But if you did allow FRA to have a tournament cruiser and you allow them to take shuttle bombs in place of some of their regular shuttles,
mm-hmm.
then in theory you could let the Zosmans or Velasco have them too.
Mm-hmm.
But if not, then you just use the regular Atman shuttles.
Right, right. Yeah, that was one thing actually Barry and I were discussing a little bit, which was the whole idea of an FR. The one thing we had in all of our discussions, we have never actually gone over the FRA Empire. And as I told him, basically the thing is with the FRA Empire is that other than, you know, the different versions of the Photon, there's not really much there, at least that I remember, that's unique, you know, outside of the Alpha Octant. You know, there's modifications of weapons that were in the Alpha, you know. That's why.
Well, you could do you could give if you start with, say, the battlecruiser, you could either give it the short range cannons that they start off with historically, or you could give the player the option of taking tachyon missile launchers as well. And of course, you could decide the shuttle bomb thing, but I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to lean on the fact that it actually does have a lot of alpha octane stuff, because it's a way to basically help introduce new players to Omega in a way that's not too overwhelming. And that's still quite distinct from Alpha, because, I mean, there's no tournament cruiser based on the old heavy cruiser.
Mm-hmm.
So the layout of the fact it's got armor and shields aren't as strong, but it has lots of batteries and stuff. It's a very different style of ship. And so mm-hmm. I do think that it has it would be a good thing to include, even if okay. it's not quite as... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I'll definitely take a look at the ships to see it. And maybe, you know, in the future, Barry and I will discuss that one too. Which I think... Yeah, maybe it has some points, because I know Barry said, you know, he did bring up some points about it, and I didn't even realize that some of those FRA ships actually have armor, which is interesting.
Well, all of the bigger ships, the cruisers and dreadnoughts, they're derived from the Terran, the whole heavy cruiser, a light cruiser, I should say. Mm-hmm. So they have armor as well. But their shields are a little bit weaker because of it.
Understood. Because, yeah, I'm not sure if the shields for the Omegas were originally weaker or not. I know they were originally slower. But I'm not sure about that the shields were weaker or not.
Well, most cruisers in Omega, heavy cruisers, have only 26 warp. The FRA heavy cruiser, or battle cruiser rather, has 29 warp. And the Zosmans, they start off with 24 warp, but the warp refit gives them 30 warp. So you could basically pick an FRA ship. I'd probably recommend the battle cruiser and then work back from that.
Mm-hmm.
And... you know, give it a refit up to warp 30, and you know, if there's any systems that need to be, you know, modified or taken out or whatever, then do that too.
Mm-hmm. I think that's we probably go around that, because I think that we made sure that the Omegas, when it comes to the tournament cruisers that we've discussed, can at least go up to speed 30. You know, they have enough warp power to actually make it to speed 31 if they need to, yeah. Okay, well, with that, I think, Gary, we will call a night. It's been a pleasure talking to you again. It's been a very, very long time.
And I hope thanks for having me, and yeah. Best wishes to everyone, both there and also at ADB. There's been both good and bad news there, so, well, not bad, but, you know. Yeah, mm-hmm. News of the times, but also much better news as well. So,
understood.
Of course, my best wishes to everyone there too.
Yes. Okay. Well, you have a good night. Bye.
Thank you.
So, a nice little discussion there about the LMC, and obviously, I had to bring up the Jamakians, and we got a little discussion about the Zosman for this evening. It's been a pleasure actually talking with Gary, who's very knowledgeable about the history of ADB, the whole Starfleet universe. I always am interested to hear about those things, you know, from the LMC to the M81, which I forgot the name of the galaxy, and I apologize for forgetting it's M81, and other things. Obviously, I like reading about those things. I rarely these days have an opportunity to actually read them, but it is what it is. So, with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.